Hello, for the lore of the land, this is Jack Leffler. My great friend William Dubuis is definitely one of the most intelligent people I've ever known in this lifetime. He's also one of the most talented writers to have emerged from the North American Southwest, a region wherein he achieved indigeneity in his early adulthood. Over the years, Bill Dubuis and I have shared many interesting adventures and forays into those realms of speculation that have dominated our consciousness, namely, how do we as a species consciously reintegrate with the flow of nature in such a way that we may proceed in harmony with homeland, rather than continue to lay waste to this paradise into which we've been born. What follows is a sound collage of excerpts from William Dubuis' Ruminations.
John Wesley Powell. Here we see his map of the major watersheds of the so-called arid lands, along with their sub-watersheds in different shadings. And he proposed that the governance of the West be organized watershed by watershed. And if you look closely at this, you can see how completely he ignored state boundaries, which is a wonderful, wonderful relief from the usual division of the landscape of the West. This was the first true bioregional plan. Powell was a fascinating character. He was truly an American original. He was the first fully realized combination of explorer, government bureaucrat, and scientist, all rolled into one. He wasn't a very big man, of medium stature, not very heavily built, but very wiry, very strong. As most people know, he lost the greater part of his right arm at the Battle of Shiloh in the Civil War, but that never slowed him down. And in fact, it was with only one arm that he descended the Colorado River twice, rode all over the Colorado Plateau, engaged every Indian group in the region in conversation, recorded their language, many of their folk ways. We think of Powell as an explorer. He was also a geographer. He was the second head after Clarence King briefly held the position of director. Powell was the second head of the U.S. Geological Survey. A lot of people forget that he was also the founder and the first head of the Bureau of American Ethnology, the purpose of which was to capture and preserve information and artifacts and whatever knowledge could be gathered about the lifeways of North American Indians. If Powell were alive today, I think he would embrace that word bioregional with full enthusiasm, because he did see the landscape, its topography, its geology, its hydrology, its vegetation, its wildlife, the people living within it, its climate, its potential to produce food and timber and wool and all those other things. He saw all these factors as deeply intertwined, and in fact viewed things in a very ecological manner, although the word ecology had scarcely been coined in his lifetime. But he saw all these things as interconnected, that you couldn't try to maximize just one of those factors without influencing all the rest, and that in order to care for the land in a way that would allow it to support a humane and just society, you had to think about all those elements of the land together as a unified whole. And that's the essence of bioregionalism today. Well, first and foremost, when Powell got to the arid West, he saw it as a setting for an enormous human tragedy, because he foresaw, quite correctly, that the continuation of the homestead pattern of settlement would guarantee misery and suffering for the people who tried to make it on a 160-acre farm west of the 100th meridian, because he knew that with less than 20 inches of rainfall, agriculture would fail. The 160-acre farm wasn't large enough for stock raising. It wasn't big enough to be a ranch, a livestock ranch. And it absolutely could not support a family through farming based upon rainfall. Powell saw the immediate need to approach the West for settlement in a manner completely different from the approach that had been used rather successfully in the East. And the approach had to change in a number of ways. The surveys had to be different. This land was not uniformly flat, and it was not homogeneous. It was broken and mountainous, and there was timber here and grazing there and water over there and so forth. And the elements that people needed in the landscape were not uniformly distributed as they had been in other places. Powell also saw that the units of land that people needed in order to survive were very different depending on their activity. Someone who was going to make a go of it with a ranch needed a lot of land. Someone who was going to be a farmer, well, if a person was going to be a farmer west of the 100th meridian, that person, that family, needed to irrigate their land. So that farm needed a source of irrigation water, and B, it didn't need to be 160 acres, because with irrigation, one could produce the food for a family and a surplus for selling at market on a good deal less than 160 acres. So all of these things had to be adjusted from the original Homestead Act vision. Powell never really anticipated the degree to which the West would become industrialized, let alone the degree to which it would become urbanized. The West is today the most urban area of the United States. More people live in cities in the West than in any other part of the country. And those cities are growing. And they're growing on a land base, and more particularly a water base, that is not growing. In fact, the water base is probably, with climate change, shrinking. Quite a few models of the future effects of climate change predict the middle latitudes of Western North America will experience a significant decline in precipitation and consequent stream flow over the next 50, 60, 80 years. That bodes very ill for the west of the United States. The most powerful thing about watershed units from a governance perspective is that if we organized ourselves politically watershed by watershed, we would be in groups that possessed interrelated interests. The people at the top of the watershed affect the people at the bottom of the watershed. The people at the bottom of the watershed have an interest in the resources at the top of the watershed, therefore. And people would be unified instead of, in our present arrangement, being so fragmented, county by county, or in polities that are too big to think bi-regionally, which the state of New Mexico certainly is. We wind up divided by the conflicts in our interests rather than unified by the interrelation of our interests. And a watershed is a natural unit for interrelated interests, because everything that goes on in the watershed affects the water quality that the people in that geographic region depend on. That's consistent with John Wesley Powell's formula for the West. He believed each of these units should be politically independent, and that the land within it, the irrigable land, would be owned individually by families. But the grazing land and the timberland would be managed communally by the whole watershed. But the fee, the underlying ownership interest, would remain with the sovereign, the federal government. Which is to say that the watershed communities, commonwealths, could never sell off the commons. He would have to remain commons. Now, I don't know whether in this he was drawing on the model of the Spanish and Mexican land grants here, but under Spanish and Mexican law, that's exactly how those lands were set up, that in a sense the sovereign retained the fee. To me, the most amazing thing about wilderness in America is how astonishingly and entirely accidentally far-sighted the concept of wilderness was. When Aldo Leopold and Arthur Carhart and others first came up with the idea, it was based mainly on a desire to preserve a certain cluster of cultural values, mainly Anglo-cultural values, about being able to go out and behave like a pioneer in sort of a fantasy of untrammeled nature, a fantasy because by the time the wilderness concept came along, the Indians had been removed from all those wilderness areas, and so they weren't anything like what they had been when they were truly wild. The wildest thing there had been taken away. Anyhow, Leopold and Carhart had an idea of these wonderful recreational islands that would preserve what was left of pristine America and preserve an opportunity for Americans to interact with what was left of pristine America. And today, we wouldn't do things that way, probably. But what really intrigues me is that these areas have become sort of savings accounts of the natural world. They are what we've put aside. And what we've put aside functions in an important way to buffer how little we really understand about living with nature. These are reservoirs that can potentially protect us from the effects of our own ignorance. If we were designing a wilderness system from scratch today, I warrant that scientifically that kind of idea would rate very high among the priorities of what we want the system to serve. And moreover, instead of creating a system of islands dropped here and there and all around, we would instead be creating systems of fat places connected by skinny links. And by so doing, we would reinforce that idea of reserving something for the natural world, again, to buffer our ignorance, and not incidentally, to provide places for people to go to understand better how complex the manifestations of this planet really are. Corridors are so vitally important because it's through corridors that wildlife, of course, move and that seeds travel and all manner of things communicate through the landscape. To imagine how important a corridor is, think about its opposite. Think about an interstate highway or the Central Arizona Project with that canal that just severs the Tonto Plateau into two pieces. Nothing can get across that damn thing. The Alaska Pipeline, at least, was designed with passages in it for caribou to make it back and forth. But so much of the landscape in the lower 48 is just riven with these absolutely uncrossable barriers for wildlife in particular. And corridors are the antithesis of that. Corridors are the connectivity of the natural world. And these days, when people talk about how they want their towns and suburbs and places where they live to function, you hear them talk about trails. You hear them talk about connections so that kids can get from home to the ballpark or to school or whatever. And corridors are just the analog in the natural world, and they're no less important. So many of our wilderness areas in New Mexico are the tops of key watersheds, and that's not an accident. when Americans first got around to protecting land, among the first lands they protected were the tops of key watersheds. And they did it in the name of protecting water for cities and towns and also for agriculture. And so the Pecos wilderness here, for instance, is more or less in the shape of the original Pecos Forest Reserve that was withdrawn in 1891. The San Pedro Parks is the top of that watershed. The Lihtier Peaks is the top of that small watershed there. And here we run into one of the real limitations of wilderness as it's been practiced and pursued in America, and that is that for so long it was just the most remote lands, the leftover lands. Most of our wildernesses in the United States began, the first ones tended to be high mountains, vertical landscapes, the Rocky Mountain National Park paradigm. And as we've gone farther along, we've needed, with our wilderness concept, to come down the watershed and capture representative samples of the rest of the landscape. But that's increasingly hard to do because people already have so many claims on the rest of the landscape. But if we really had our act together as a society, we would, in a sense, tithe a tenth of everything. Not just the high mountains, but have our wilderness deserts and our wilderness bosques along the lower southwestern rivers, and we'd have dry or semi-arid mesas that were also in the wilderness system, and we'd have a sample of darn near everything tucked away, our savings account against the future, our insulation against the effects of our own stupidity, of which we know we have an inexhaustible supply. My sense is that Anglo-Americans coming out of the humid East came to the West with a paradigm that said forested lands were good and anything else was kind of a lapsed forest. In the settlement of the Great Plains, people started planting trees like crazy. In fact, there was a land law, the Timber Culture Act, designed to encourage homesteaders to plant more trees in the beliefs that trees would alter the climate and make everything moister and better and all that business. And we, as a society, have been neglecting the non-timbered lands from the get-go, and we still do. The whole business of suppressing fire so aggressively in our forests is also predicated on this idea that every tree somehow needs to be protected. And out in the West here, that's crazy. There are many forested landscapes, like pinon and juniper, that under certain circumstances erode much more than they would if they were healthy grasslands established and maintained by fire. We need, as a society, to begin thinking not in terms of some certain ideal, which is all too often the forested mountainside, and to begin thinking instead, when we think ecologically, in terms of mosaics and dynamic mosaics, where one tile in one decade might be forest, and in another it might be savanna, and in another it might be grassland, because nature is dynamic, and we need to learn to live with and work with the dynamism. And this is, again, another reason why wilderness is so important, because wilderness is a place where we interfere with the land to a very small degree, and therefore we can observe and watch the dynamism and come to understand it better. Wilderness is where we will be taught to understand dynamism in the land. Well, I think wilderness can surely be the buffer against our ignorance. In our ignorance, we simplify landscapes so much. The species diversity declines when we monkey around with it too much. And wilderness is a place where that species diversity, both of flora and fauna, can remain high and become a reservoir that one day may help us repopulate other areas with the needed plants and animals. So I think of wilderness very much as a reservoir, a genetic reservoir, a spiritual reservoir, emotional reservoir, an aesthetic reservoir, all those dimensions it serves. One of the problems in the politics of wilderness, I think, is that environmentalists think they have all the answers. And I think in many cases they do, but environmentalists are increasingly an urban species. And in order to have all the answers, they need to connect better with rural folk and to get their perspective and their wisdom. As you mentioned, a lot of ranchers have deep, deep understandings of how to live with the land and how to get along with it and how it works, what parts of it are most important, what the flows are through it, that kind of thing. I love the concept that Bill McDonald of the Malpai Group named, this idea of the radical center. To my way of thinking, the radical center is where you find gathered three different groups. There are environmentalists who understand that to improve large landscapes, they need to work constructively with the people who inhabit and work in those landscapes. And the radical center includes land users, be they farmers or ranchers or even miners or loggers, who understand that society now has a much higher standard of environmental performance than it used to be. And instead of fighting against it, they accept that higher standard and move toward it. And then the radical center also includes agency people, the federal bureaucrats, who are so important to all this. But in the radical center, you find the bureaucrats who understand that getting the rubber to meet the road is what's really important and not just the defense of procedure. There are people who are focused on getting the job done. And I think for a wilderness bill to serve in New Mexico, to meet general acceptance or even just majority acceptance, we're going to need to have the elements of all three sectors of the radical center putting their shoulders to the wheel. The idea of a more or less local board running the place is kind of interesting from this standpoint, not that it is a privatization of resources, of public resources, but that it's an experiment in the de-bureaucratization of land management. It's actually something much closer to what Powell had in mind, where watershed people come together to determine how they're going to take care of their commons, instead of having experts whose loyalty is directed to a power center far away calling the shots. Most people through most of human history have lived in something like a steady state economy. This continuous growth way of life that we define as normal today is really an artifact of the modern era in Western Europe and exported to North America and really to the rest of the world today. But that's not where human beings evolved. That's not where we lived for all those millennia beforehand. We can do this. And that's the wisdom that we get from Native people, because they're still connected to that other reality, that longer heritage of human experience, and can draw on traditional knowledge about how that steady state world existed and what kind of values were necessary to underpin it. We are citizens of so many commons all the time. You know, in a sense, the atmosphere, which we're polluting with greenhouse gases, is a commons. Our watersheds are a commons. Qualities like silence is a commons. These days in America, you can hardly go any public place without hearing a dog on TV yammering away. Commons is what we share with each other, and somehow linked to this idea of transitioning to a steady state economy, we've got to transition to a set of values that is rooted in what we share together, rooted in a sense of community, rooted in our bonds to each other, rather than in our individual existences to the degree we are so preoccupied today. And where that leads is to an emphasis on quality of life rather than on quantity of consumption. Bill McKibben has done some very interesting work and has tracked a number of interesting trends and polling systems and so forth. And he is fond of citing the fact that it seems that as Americans have accumulated more possessions, they report themselves as being less happy. More toys doesn't mean more fun. And I think as we take this consumer society to its accumulating, trash-producing reductio ad absurdum, we're finding that it's not a very satisfactory way to live. So somewhere down the line, if we're going to be successful, if we're going to get into the future more or less intact, we've got to reorient our values to the primacy of the commons, to a sense of loyalty to place, to a sense of dedication to quality of life, rather than just to the continuous consumption of more and more material.
It becomes apparent that humanity shares a commons of consciousness as well as a commons of place in nature. That being the case, we need to be mindful as to what we contribute to this commons of consciousness and what we extract. The bottom line is that we live on a planet of finite resources that we have been squandering since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution 2.5 centuries past, when our human population was about 1 billion souls. Today, we number over 7 billion souls, and it's obvious that our planet cannot sustain such numbers of us at our present rate of extraction of natural resources and concurrent pollution of air, water, and landscape. Consider developing cultures of practice, beginning at the grassroots, and govern ourselves according to the dictates of our home watersheds, our home bioregions. All life is interrelated, plant life, animal life. We live in a state of symbiosis within our biotic community. If we invigorate our consciousness to recognize that we also live in a state of spiritual symbiosis with our planet, we'll come to hold our planet with reverence, this beautiful planetary commons that we share with all other forms of life. This must become the foundation of our collective perception, our commons of consciousness. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we listen to the wisdom of William Dubuis. Our radio series is a production of The Lore of the Land and is funded by a grant from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. This is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.